This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Well, hello there, Friday. It's about time, I have to say, because your pals Monday through Thursday left us with a lot to think about.
And they always do. Way, way back on Monday, lawyers for Sal DeMasi launched their defense of the former Massachusetts House Speaker.
The government has the burden of proving a case. We don't have to put on any.
Or at least not much of one, because by Wednesday, just 2 days later, DeMasi's team rested. And a little bit earlier in the week...
We're a stronger community now. I mean, everybody, neighbors helping neighbors. I mean, Munson's stronger now.
But Munson, along with many other central and western Massachusetts towns, is still suffering severe physical damage from this month's tornadoes. Initial estimates of that damage came out Tuesday, upwards of $90 million to private property alone.
And then, to round out the week...
I was just in New Hampshire. I'll be back in New Hampshire on Monday. Let me just say that there is a fundamental strategic difference between the traditional consulting community and the kind of campaign I want to run.
Well, that's one way to look at Thursday's mass exodus of Newt Gingrich's campaign staff. Another way to look at it is that he'll have a whole bevy of open seats on his campaign vehicle when he rolls into the Granite State next week for the first debate between GOP presidential hopefuls in the run-up to the New Hampshire primary. So, there's the week's news. And to help us make sense of it all, editorial page editor for the Boston Globe, Peter Canellos. Good to have you as always, Peter.
Thanks, Meghna.
And also with us today is WBUR's very own political reporter, Fred Tice. Hi there, Fred.
Hi, Meghna.
So let's start right off with the big local news here in Massachusetts, and that's the continuing aftermath of the tornadoes that struck western and central Massachusetts last week.
People are lending hands, chainsaws, everything. The outpouring of support is just amazing.
Then we are ready to make a difference in this world. Munson will rise again.
Something about the community and how we've really come together. I mean, people I haven't seen in years just working all day long without rest.
So those are voices from central and western Massachusetts. Fred, you've been out there covering this story and talking to people whose homes and lives have basically been destroyed by the storm. So what's the mood like that you were able to get a sense of?
Remarkably positive. One of the things that I really jumped out at me is the use of social media for connecting people who want to offer help with people who need help. And until now, there's always been a great disjuncture between people who want to help and people who need help. Do people bring too many clothes always, for example, right? Well, in Munson, they've seemed to have figured out a pretty good way using Facebook and also using some databases that they've set up, just using a couple of PCs to really match people so that when somebody shows up and says, I need somebody to get a tree down over my house, half an hour later, there are people with chainsaws getting rid of that tree. It's really quite amazing. And they think that this is going to be able to be replicated across the state in towns hit by tornadoes, and also they think it's a lesson for the rest of the world, really, when they're hit with disasters.
Well, what's really interesting about that is that when we think of the use of social media and disasters, we think of, people here in the Boston area tweeting hashtag pray for Japan, 10,000 miles away. But this is social media at work at a local level.
Very much so. And maybe that's why it works so well, because let's face it, the person who can fulfill your need may just be a few blocks away.
Mm-hmm. Peter, do you think that, the damage out there is so striking that it seems like there's no way that it's going to be a short road to recovery for so many towns in central and western Massachusetts that were already suffering mightily in this sort of recessed economy we have?
No, it absolutely won't be. And Springfield has already asked permission from the state to run a deficit this year to try to work on the cleanup. But I would sort of reemphasize some of what Fred was saying, that Springfield, as we know, had been in receivership. It's a somewhat troubled city. The government is just getting its act together. There are a lot of challenges in the school system and beyond. And sometimes these disasters and the need to rally around the community in the wake of one of these disasters can promote a rallying around effect that will have spillover in other areas, like the commitment to the schools and to other civic institutions.
Well, there's obviously a lot of ongoing coverage there that we'll all be keeping up with what's happening in central and western Massachusetts. But let's move on to the next story that we want to tackle for this week, and that is the upcoming, in a way, debate up in New Hampshire on Monday with GOP presidential primary hopefuls. There is a bit of a crowded field now. We've got, let's see if I get all the names right. Of course, there's former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney, former Speaker of the United States House Newt Gingrich, Texas Congressman Ron Paul, former Minnesota Governor Tim Pawlenty, Minnesota Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann, businessman Herman Cain, and former Pennsylvania Senator Rick Santorum. So, Fred, is this the herd as we know it, or any future additions, you think?
Well, you know, there's somebody who really does want to be added, and this is what really jumps out at me, is that the two-term governor of New Mexico, Gary Johnson, has not been invited to this debate. Obviously, the organizers of the debate, CNN, the Manchester Union Leader, and also Channel 9 in Manchester, have to protect themselves in some way and say they have to establish some kind of parameter for letting people in. There are too many presidential candidates. They can't let everybody in. But what they've done is say you need to reach X number of percentage in X number of polls locally and nationwide. Otherwise, you're not in the debate. Well, Gary Johnson didn't make their standard. So he's been locked out. And the Log Cabin Republicans, which is the National Gay Republican Group, and College Republicans are protesting on his behalf. They're pointing out that under the same standards, Michael Dukakis and Bill Clinton would not have been invited to the debate either. And isn't the New Hampshire presidential primary supposed to be about letting people take a look at these dark horses
as closely as they can?
Yeah, and some of these dark horses end up being the nominees of their party.
Peter, I want to get your thought here in just a second, but there's a little bit of tape I also want to play, so hang on for a moment, because it focuses on former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney. As we all know, he made his presidential run official in New Hampshire, and when he did that, he also held his first town hall meeting in the state as well, and it was during that town hall meeting that he said this.
I don't speak for the scientific community, of course, but I believe the world is getting warmer. And number two, I believe that humans contribute to that.
So that caused, let's say, a little bit of drama in conservative circles. And here is maybe the king of that drama, Rush Limbaugh, responding this week.
Bye-bye nomination. Another one down.
Okay, so that might be a little too simple, Peter, but it sort of exemplifies Romney's continuing conundrum about being the quote-unquote moderate in this field.
Well, I think it's what you're seeing is that Romney is running more as himself this time around than he did in 2008. He's running on the economy, which is his strong suit. It's what he knows about. He's been a businessman. He can analyze these financial issues very, very well. And he's not running away from his positions in Massachusetts in quite the same way he did in 2008. I have to say, with this crowded field, Romney only looks stronger because the more and more people that get in, it kind of diminishes the ability of somebody who could be a very serious challenger to him, like Tim Pawlenty. You know, in that debate, Tim Pawlenty will only have, you know, 5 minutes of airtime to try to get his points across, because people like Herman Cain and Rick Santorum will be hogging all the airtime. So Romney's looking pretty good right now.
Well, there's one more topic from the week's news that I want to get in here before we run out of time, and that, of course, is the trial of former Massachusetts House Speaker Sal DeMasi. Today, lawyers in that corruption trial made closing arguments. The real big surprise this week was how short the defense's case was. Just a couple days. I mean, the prosecution took an entire month to lay out its argument. So, Peter Canellos, I mean, one could say that means that maybe the defense is actually supremely confident about its case in defending DeMasi. Your thoughts? There.
Well, I don't think that's what it means, but I think it does mean that they're basing their entire defense on discrediting the prosecution witnesses, particularly Joseph Lally, who's the person who kind of ties together this whole conspiracy. And I think their point is going to be something like, you may not like the fact that DeMasi was getting these referral fees and stuff, but it wasn't a conspiracy. There was no quid pro quo. He wasn't asking for anything. It's just Lally turning state's evidence and lying. That's basically his defense.
I mean, is there any risk in placing so much emphasis on discrediting the prosecution?
Well, I mean, obviously, they would have loved to have, you know, six people come forward and say that Lally had told them he was going to lie for such and such a reason or something like that. So obviously, you know, you can conjure up a better defense than this one. But for this kind of a case, it's not unusual to spend the defense time challenging the prosecution witnesses rather than putting witnesses of their own on.
Fred, you spend a lot of time up on Beacon Hill. Do you have any sense or thoughts on how the case may affect the atmosphere in the statehouse?
My guess is is not much. Things will go on as they always have. This is obviously the trial has brought out the way that business gets done on Beacon Hill, all the influence peddling, to be polite about it. I see no indication that that's going to change.
All right. Well, still a little sunshine may hopefully go a long way. While we have a few minutes left here, why don't we hit our hubbubs? And that, of course, is some of the news of the week that didn't make it to sort of above the fold status. And let's start with Anthony, your hubbub.
Hi, Magna. Okay, so we made mention briefly earlier in the show of Newt Gingrich's troubled campaign. The staff of the former House Speaker resigned en masse yesterday. Gingrich says his campaign is still viable, but one wonders if those defections could make his campaign one of the shortest ever. And then it turns out there was news yesterday of an even shorter presidential campaign. Karl Rove, the master tactician, of course, who helped get George W. Bush elected twice, stepped before an audience in Manchester and began his speech with these words: "I'm Karl Rove, I'm running for president, and I'm in it to win." Really? He paused. Well, no. Rove quickly followed up with, "Just kidding." So a bit of Karl Rove humor there, but I like the idea that maybe he launched and ended the shortest campaign for president ever.
I can imagine what the faces in the crowd must have been thinking. How do we respond to this? Peter Kanellis, your hubbub?
We heard some bad news about two bookstores closing in the Boston area, George Bookstore in Harvard Square, and now the big downtown crossing Borders. This is obviously a sign of the pressure that's on the book industry from e-books. But I think that, we're losing a precious resource. I mean, people in many communities like to go to the local bookstore and browse around and, talk to the people who work there about the different titles and look and see. And some of that serendipity is being taken out of the book prying process, and that's unfortunate.
Oh, the Curious George store. I mean, and that's also the second major sort of local bookstore that's been lost in Harvard Square. Years ago, I believe it was the Wordsworth Books that closed down.
Yeah,
there as well.
They were the same owner. Yeah.
Yeah. Fred, you're a hubbub.
An East Boston story, the paintings in the East Boston Public Library at Maverick Square. The public library is building a big, new, shiny public library for East Boston, consolidating the two smaller branches there. And they didn't include in their grand modern design something that's very cherished by the community there, these paintings of ships, a lot of which had been built in East Boston. This was a WPA project, Works Project Administration, built in the Depression. And the community was very upset that there was going to be no room for these ships. They protested, and it looks like these paintings are now going to be put up in the Boston Public Library. However, very telling about how the city of Boston works. We've never been able to find out in a timely fashion. When I say we, I as a reporter, people in East Boston as a community, when the meetings were going to occur. Initially, we were told that the press wasn't going to be allowed to show up. When I inquired about that, then we were told, okay, we could show up. But it's still really hard to find out when these meetings are. And the people in East Boston are kind of suspicious that something might still happen at the last minute. So they're watching vigilantly to make sure that their paintings get moved over to the public library, the new building, when it happens. Yeah.
All right. So my hubbub sort of will piggyback off this government and transparency theme you seem to have brought up. It's not terribly local, but I'm doing it in honor of Sarah Palin's recent visit to Boston. And that is that today at 2 p.m. Eastern, 9 a.m. Juneau, Alaska time, a trove of 24,199 emails between Sarah Palin and members of her staff when she was governor of Alaska have been released, as per a FOIA request that took almost 1,000 days to fulfill. Okay, so that in and of itself may be not that interesting. But what caught my attention is that at least a half dozen, if not more, media outlets that now have these boxes of paper that are full of emails are actually crowdsourcing them. They are releasing them almost instantaneously on the internet and asking you, me, anybody who wants to take a look and help find potentially interesting gems. And you can look at this in multiple ways. It's the media just abdicating its role as sort of thoughtful gatekeepers of information. It could be the purpose of FOIA most beautifully fulfilled, information into the public, or maybe it's just the reality that we live in the era of WikiLeaks and crowdsourcing and information at the tip of everyone's fingertips. I'm not quite sure what I think about that. But
maybe all of the above.
Maybe all of the above. Fred Tice, political reporter for WBUR, thank you so much today.
Great to be here.
And Peter Kanellis, editorial page editor of the Boston Globe, thank you so much and have a great weekend.